Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and thank you for tuning into episode 141 of Speaking of Mysteries. My guest for the podcast is Sebastian Rotella, whose Rip Crew, the third in his series about Border Patrol agent turned investigator Valentine Pescatore, was published a few weeks ago. I'm a big fan of Sebastian's work, both as a senior investigative reporter for ProPublica, as well as his fiction. So it's a longish interview, but so worth it. Here's Sebastian Rotella to talk about Rip Crew. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm very excited to have Sebastian Rotella on the show to talk about his third Valentine Pescatore book, Rip Crew. Welcome, Sebastian.
Thank you, Nancy. It's always a pleasure.
Well, you and I've actually covered all three of your books now, so I'm very, very proud of that.
And I'm very happy that you have.
So congratulations on this. I'm happy that Valentine is back. He's a very complicated and some might say conflicted guy. So I don't think I've ever asked you this before, but where did he come from in your imagination? How did you cobble him together?
That's a great question, and these, especially as the character evolves over books, you start to ask yourself the same question and think about, especially a young character like this, right, about how he evolves and where he comes from. I mean, if you remember in the first book, he was a young Border Patrol agent, a rookie Border Patrol agent. So and my first book was very much about the U.S.-Mexican border, and so he came in his origins, so to speak, were partly he was modeled on some young Hispanic Border Patrol agents I'd met or knew of who were, on the one hand, very gung-ho and very proud to be agents, but on the other, young enough and from tough enough backgrounds that they had some inner conflict going on, either about the job or, they were kind of walking the tightrope between being a cop and being a criminal, so that was that part of it was that, and part of it came from people I had known who hadn't necessarily been in law enforcement, but people I knew from when I was younger, or I dealt with, at different times in my career, who had that ability, and I'm thinking particularly of people I knew back in Chicago, who kind of, because of where they were brought up and their ethnic background, who were kind of had a mix of cultures going on, who could sort of were adept at operating like in kind of like a chameleon in different environments, and had a sort of an ear and an eye for different situations and different languages, and could sort of cross borders with ease. So all those kinds of things went into it, into that character, who I think, as I said, who was young, who was only 25 in that book, and that was part of the point of his character in that book. He was kind of very intense and conflicted and kind of filled with rage. And by the third book, he's older and a little calmer and a little more focused and mature, but he still has that that wild or fierce side.
Well, one of the things I always felt was most interesting about Valentine was he is of Italian and Mexican descent, but he's from Chicago. So when he gets to San Diego, the border town where he is a border agent, his Spanish is not Southern California Mexican Spanish, which is very unique. And different from, for instance, his sometime girlfriend, and we'll talk about her later, Isabel, who is Cuban-American, and their Spanish is very different. And I thought that was such a refreshing look at the Hispanic culture in the United States, because it is not uniform.
Exactly. That's very true, and I'm glad you made that point. And that was the other thing I think was going on. I mean, I was struck when I was covering the Border Patrol back when I was a younger reporter and got to know a lot of the agents, how many of them were, proud Americans, but were also the children of immigrants and moving back and forth among those, worlds and cultures and languages. And that was part of what was going on with him and what you just said. So he's an interesting mix. And he's very much inspired by people I knew in this sense, too, in Chicago, where you have so many sort of these ethnic villages. So he's of Italian-Argentine descent, and that's where sort of his Spanish comes from. He's also Mexican-American, but there are generations of Mexican-Americans in Chicago who go back to, the early 20th century who came to work in the steel mills and the factories and really don't speak Spanish necessarily that well. So the more you learn about those cultures and about the Latino culture, you know, the more diverse it is and the more diverse kinds of Spanish there are and experiences there are. And that's one of the things that I think comes out kind of naturally in through his character and through the books in general.
Well, excuse me, I'm going to wax philosophical for this question. You recently wrote a column for crimereads.com, which is a new site that covers crime fiction, and it was an excellent column. And you attribute both your careers, reporting on crimes and writing crime fiction, to being from Chicago. And like Michael Connelly, with whom I believe you worked at the LA Times, you saw journalism as a way to make a living, you know, the good old days. And like Connelly, you worked the crime beat. You saw some of the worst things humankind is capable of. And it got me to thinking, although you always wanted to write crime fiction, did the writing of it become a form of therapy? After all, attacking reporters, even in this country, has become something of a blood sport.
I mean, it became a form. I don't know. I mean, therapy would be one word. I mean, it certainly, you know, some of the places I was covering, you know, especially the Mexican border and Latin America or covering terrorism, you know, they're very intense experiences where, as you know, as a journalist, you know, you're completely consumed by the coverage and by the beat and you know, just sort of physically and psychologically invested in it and obsessed with it. And sometimes when you're covering, you know, things like I've covered, like assassinations or terrorist attacks, you know, sort of plunged into it, and you're thinking very fast, but you don't always have that much time to reflect. And the stories and the characters and the material and the experiences and the emotions kind of build up. And it's true, I guess, that one of the things that happened when I was writing fiction is I could go back to that, you know, that sort of that wealth of experience and emotion and knowledge and sort of and think back on these experiences and tell these stories and express some of that, you know, with more time and more liberty and authority. So I think that's part of what was going on. You know, is that it's a way of revisiting these things, of thinking about them, and telling. Telling some of the larger stories, which are inspired, you know, you change them and cobble together stories and characters, and you know, from a lot of different experiences to come up with the book. But that's certainly part of the process that was going on.
Well, as far as my journalism career is concerned, I was pretty much stuck covering celebrities. So about the most dire circumstance I could ever encounter is a publicist not knowing where to go.
Well, the trenches are the trenches.
But the slings and arrows, they might not, the slings and arrows, at least the verbal ones, could be just as barbed. No one ever took a shot at me, though, so that's, they might have wanted to, but they never did. I think your first novel, Triple Crossing, where you introduced Valentin to the world when you said he's 25 years old, was one of the first books, fiction or nonfiction, that brought home the globalization of crime, at least to me. I mean, you were covering it, and your fellow journos who were covering it certainly knew about it. But as just kind of a casual lightweight like I am, I probably knew about it, but it really brought it home. And the world's governments right now may be headed towards economic protectionism, but I don't think crime is. In Rip Crew, there's still plenty of globalized crime, isn't there?
There is, you know, and I've tried to, you know, that's certainly been one of the topics that I cover and stay abreast of all through my career and I'm now. And there's a couple of underworlds that I try to explore in particular. One is certainly the smuggling underworld, you know, the global smuggling underworld, which I've gone back to after having covered the border full time. I've gone, you know, remained obsessed with borders and with migration, and have had the opportunity in recent years to cover it in places like Lampedusa in Italy, you know, so that whole wave of smuggling and migration, which is so dangerous and so fraught with peril from Africa into Italy where a lot of these smuggling flotillas end up on the island of Lampedusa. And at the southern Mexican border, which, despite what you might read in the newspapers, you know, most illegal immigration American into the United States today is not Mexican but Central American. So that southern border is the front line where most illegal immigrants, whether from Central America or elsewhere around the world, cross before they make their way across Mexico, that very treacherous journey into the United States. And so one of the big narrative strands in the book is exploring that smuggling underworld and those ever more desperate diasporas and odysseys that migrants go through, and trying to show some of the connections, how places like Lampedusa and the southern Mexican border are closer than they might seem, and how these networks bring them together and these smuggling and migration experiences. And the other, which I think I talked to you when we talked about my last book that was sort of taking shape as an idea, was I was thinking the other is more about globalized crime in the United States, and particularly in the white collar or the financial sector. And the thought process I went through then was, when I spent a lot of time as a foreign correspondent or an investigative journalist based in the States, but investigating this kind of activity overseas. So I've investigated Latin American cartels, and I've investigated Iranian or Pakistani intelligence services involved in terrorism and things like that. So it's always kind of been about foreign bad guys and this exotic lawlessness, this idea of impunity that is really a very familiar phrase, say, in Latin America, la impunidad, where corrupt politicians and terrorists and gangsters get away in kind of a structural way with crime and at every level because the justice systems are weak. And obviously, in the United States, the rule of law is much stronger, and our courts and police work at a much more effective way than they do in many other places in the world, whether Latin America or Russia or wherever you'd like. But the thing I did start thinking about in recent years was, after having covered all these bad guys, quote-unquote, around the world, was what was going on in the United States and this idea of impunity and the ways in which it did also exist in the U.S. And I thought particularly about the financial sector and the executive sector, and some of the things that have really sort of begun to alarm more and more observers in the U.S. in the past decade, ever since the financial crisis of 2008, where, as you remember, no one really of any significance went to prison, for all that wrongdoing and all those, ruined lives and all those lost, all that money that was lost. And other trends like the profound decline in white-collar prosecutions by the U.S. Justice Department, something that's actually been documented by some of my colleagues at ProPublica. Some of the ways in which, this idea of these mafias, like foreign mafias, intersect with the so-called legitimate economy. There have been a number of very major cases where reputable banks in the United States, for example, have been fined huge amounts of money for laundering drug money and money from foreign corruption and things like that. So that's the other kind of globalized crime I try to look at, the kind that's happening right here in the U.S. And that, doesn't necessarily get looked at. When we talk about the idea of mafias, it doesn't fit into the traditional scheme, but I would argue is much more connected to that world, and the lines are much more blurry than we might think.
Well, and timely. I've talked about this with some other writers who've written books that just seem to hit a chord, and that certainly hit a chord with me. I think there's a tremendous amount of impunity among white-collar individuals in banking and manufacturing, and some of the enabling that they are currently enjoying from the current administration. I think that it strikes a chord, and the idea of sort of a mutual strange bedfellows kind of alliances between organized crime and the government, whether it's turning a blind eye or actively engaging with them, goes back pretty far. I mean, even in World War II, in the run-up to World War II, the Justice Department was reaching out to the Italian mafia in New York on the docks, looking for, interestingly enough, appealing to their patriotism and looking for German agents. So I think that this is nothing new. It's just surprising every time it's pointed out, as it is so eloquently in your book.
I think that's right. I think you make a very good point. It isn't. This is something that has gone on in different ways and different manifestations. In fact, this idea of connections between, say, intelligence services and mafias and things like that, or the idea that that great fortunes often have dubious origins, right? I think what's interesting with the globalization is how, first of all, how much money we're talking about and how much of it moves so rapidly through, incredibly complex and sophisticated networks. And it seems like there's two things going on. One is there's just an increasingly sort of mainstream acceptance of very predatory practices and things that like during the stock market crisis, or the financial crisis of 2008, things that you think that should be and perhaps, are right on the border of being illegal, like knowingly selling bad financial instruments to people, right, which sometimes is a crime and sometimes isn't, so sort of mainstream practices that seem predatory to the point of being certainly unethical, if not illegal. And then again, the way that, because there is so much money out there being generated in places where there is lawlessness, it inevitably makes its way into the U.S. and to the Western financial system. And often, that's something that's encouraged, whether it's some of the banks that have been fined because they were laundering money that clearly it wouldn't have been too hard to figure out that it was coming from, it was cash coming from Mexican cartels, or some of the Russian oligarch money that has made its way into the U.S. real estate sector or into the financial markets of London, things like that. So, I think globalization has intensified it both in scope and volume and the difficulty. I mean, I think of just of overwhelming regulation and law enforcement in a lot of places.
So let's get to the title of your book. You named it Rip Crew, and that is a particularly nasty and effective business tactic, isn't it? So I wanted you to talk a little bit about the title of the book and what that is.
Sure. I mean, I always, it's a phrase that that had always been in my head ever since I'd heard about Rip Crews, and I first heard about them covering the border and had some long conversations with people in the Border Patrol and U.S. and Mexican law enforcement who dealt with them in undercover operations and enforcement operations and realized how dangerous they were. And I just thought it worked really well as a title and as a concept on a number of levels. I mean, what a Rip Crew is Rip Crews are the armed gangs that operate on both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border, and they prey on smugglers. So they're criminals who prey on the criminal industries of smuggling. They rob, and it's obviously very dangerous and very violent inherently, right, when you have criminals robbing other criminals. They rob drug dealers. They rip off their drug loads and sell them. Or they do something particularly dangerous and scary. They rob the smugglers of migrants. So smugglers who are moving illegal immigrants, they will, essentially at gunpoint kidnap the migrants and hold the migrants for ransom from the smugglers, which often involves these smugglers getting killed. And so Rip Crews are known in Mexico, in northern Mexico, as bajadores, and they're in Central America as tumbadores. But that's essentially what they do. They prey on the criminal industry. And I thought it was a great title too, and a great idea, because it also reflected, the kind of predatory activity, that criminals engage in, both sort of on the street and out there in the borderlands, but also the kind of thing we were just talking about in terms of some of these other kinds of crime at a higher level, whether it's mafias, blue collar, quote unquote, or white collar mafias. And so I thought it worked on a number of levels, as this idea of these predatory forces at work, and this whole idea of the interplay between the criminal and the illicit economy.
So it also in the book, and this is something that you share with Don Winslow, another writer to be in whose company is a pretty good thing. You both feature strong supporting characters in your novels who are journalists. In your case, it's Leo Mendez. And you wrote about this specifically in the crimereads.com column, and I hadn't really thought about it before. So I'd like you to talk about Señor Méndez and how he came about.
Sure. I mean, I was struck by this in my coverage of the Mexican border in Latin America and met people, you know, like Méndez, and he's inspired by a good half dozen people I met in Mexico and in Latin America. And the idea there is, and when we meet him, he's, you know, he first appears in Triple Crossing. He's, you know, that book, like Rip Crew, alternates between the perspectives of Pescador and Méndez. And Méndez has a job description which is actually much more realistic than it may sound. He's a journalist by training who becomes a human rights activist, and in Triple Crossing finds himself propelled into a situation where he is recruited and accepts a job being essentially a police chief, overseeing an anti-corruption unit that essentially investigates corruption by law enforcement. And that is very much inspired by the fact that in Latin America in the past couple of decades, as this problem of law enforcement and justice corruption has become so dangerous and overwhelming and entrenched, and in sort of the despair of governments of trying to clean up the police in particular, there has been an increasing sort of trend of turning to outsiders, of people who are not from the culture of police. And so, and what has happened is people have been brought in from academia, from human rights, and from journalism. And there's a couple of examples I know of people who had that background, you know, who covered, you know, knew a lot about crime and law enforcement and justice as journalists, and ended up crossing over and serving in government because they were outsiders, you know, which is both their strength and their weakness, right? I mean, their strength is that they're knowledgeable but honest and don't have the kind of connections or the kind of temptation that people in the culture do, but their weakness is that they're essentially people who are in over their head, and that, you know, they're not professionals. That kind of thing. They're improvising, and so Méndez in the first book is, you know, he's recruited into this job, and he is qualified for it because, like so many Latin American journalists, he has found himself investigating, you know, corruption and crime in the cartels and high level wrongdoing, and filling a vacuum or a void where police and prosecutors should be. That has happened time and again all over Latin America and other places where journalists find themselves, you know, in great peril. Mexico is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist because they are out there doing the work that, you know, in societies where the rule of law is stronger would be done by the authorities. And so he represents, but he's also a tribute to those very brave, very talented journalists I've met who, whether they actually ended up doing that kind of law enforcement work or whether just through their reporting, put themselves in great danger, and, you know, some of whom died as a result of it, people I've known. But that is really, you know, it's something that we as U.S. journalists or European journalists, you know, the people in the West don't really realize what it's like to be a journalist in those societies and the kind of cases they find themselves involved in, and these are people who have the power sometimes to bring down corrupt governments, but who also pay an incredible price because of the role that journalists play in those societies. And in this book, he has returned to being a journalist, and he's in exile. He's also evolved. He finds himself, he's had to flee because of death threats into the United States. And he's living in San Diego, trying to sort of, he misses being a cop, but he's returned to work as a journalist on the U.S. side, and is a bit of a fish out of water, and doing his best to return to his original profession.
In this book, Valentin does sort of get together with people like Leo Méndez. Isabel is back in the picture now, working for Homeland Security. And even Fatima, the woman he met in France, or he actually met her in Argentina, but had gone back to be a law enforcement officer in France. All of these people come together, and this is, it is such a complicated case that he's working on. It's really difficult to distill it to a soundbite, except to say it involves all the things you've mentioned. The impunity of many men, and it's mostly men, in the financial industry in New York, and the ruthlessness of smugglers of both human capital and counterfeit goods in Italy and Central America. And, you know, it's just a fascinating story, and something is a little bit like ripped from the headlines.
You know, it's interesting because I try in my books, on the one hand, not to make too many references to sort of politics or you know, things that would date the book. But I do think, I think that, you know, this is something I started writing, you know, and as you know, when you talk about a book, by the time you talk about it, it was actually conceived of and written, at least in the first draft, a couple of years ago. But I do think that quite a few of the themes that I address have become, you know, more relevant, you know, in the past couple of years, as this whole focus, you know, once again, there's so much debate, so much of it ill-informed and extreme about the border and about migration, and some of these other issues that we've been talking about. I do feel that is timely, and I think part of that comes from if you are both thinking about these things and reporting about them. You know, I think this happened with my book about terrorism too. Some of the trends I kind of was talking about that I see closer, not because I'm a genius, but just because I'm covering it more closely, you know, and out there sort of out in the places where you learn about these things on the front line, they sort of make their way into, tend to sort of rise as sort of stories in the news, maybe a little later on, you know, as the book comes out. So that's something, you know, that's true. I'm proud of it, and I'm glad, you know, hopefully that will enrich the reading experience.
These stories sort of percolate through your imagination to the surface.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that I was trying to also look at in this—I mean, I was trying to tell a story that was maybe a little more, you know, as you said, it's complicated in some ways, but it's simple in others. In other words, there's this massacre, there's a mystery at the beginning of the book, and you know, and we want to know what happened and why, and you know, and it follows a lot of. It moves around the world, and it, you know, there are twists and turns. But I think when it all comes together, I think it's. You know, a lot of it has to do with themes that are stark and you know, in some ways not that complicated about power and about greed and about venality and about, you know, certain kinds of impunity, about the victimization of migrants, of the victimization of women and women migrants in particular, you know, and how those things might happen in a place like Libya or Lampedusa to African migrants going to Europe, or might happen coming up to the people coming up to the United States, but they're kind of universal to those underworlds and that experience. And that was one of the reasons that, you know, in this book that in particular, it's about one of the important characters is an African, an Eritrean migrant, a woman, because that's, you know, and that sort of happened because I was down at the border in Guatemala talking to migrants and ran into an Eritrean woman in a detention center and was talking to her, and she was telling me about this odyssey she'd had where she'd left Eritrea, made her way through Sudan to South Africa, over to Brazil, and then finally had been caught coming into Mexico from Guatemala. And it was just interesting because this was, you know, This was this global odyssey that summed up what was going on in so many different places. So that's one of the reasons I focused on this, because when you look at the victimization of migrants, particularly women, whether it's in the smuggling underworld in Latin America or, you know, going up through Africa to Europe, you know, these are really horrific stories that don't necessarily get the attention they should unless, you know, a ship sinks with 200 people on it or something like that. But otherwise, you know, the day in, day out, you know, the more, you know, you learn about it, the more it has an effect on you. And I wanted to kind of bring it out in this story, you know, trying to bring out this larger story through, you know, telling, you know, trying to evoke a couple of these specific characters.
Well, there was another character in this story, and that was the priest. You have a priest who works in some of the most dire conditions in Central America and the border between Guatemala and Mexico. And for some reason, this reminded me of the Jesuits' anti-communist network in Italy, which was rumored to have been utilized by the CIA. And for some reason, I am so fascinated with this idea of an alternate communication network through Catholic priests. So I might be reading way too much into it, but I found it interesting that he sort of could navigate where others could not.
Well, I think, you know, it's very interesting you say that and very astute. I mean, it's a fictional order in the book, but certainly it's not going to, you know, it's not no problem revealing that one of the inspirations for that is an order of priests I've encountered around the world, starting in Tijuana, but also in Italy, dealing with African migrants, and in Argentina, and right here in the U.S. dealing with Italian ones, the Scalabrinian order, and you know, and they are priests whose vocation is to tend to migrants and refugees around the world, and they have these remarkable networks, and they're usually very, very. Because of the kind of environments they have to work in, they're very streetwise, and they're also very well, you know, they're very sort of cultured and well-educated and worldly and know a lot about, you know, migration patterns and the immigrant experience all over. So that character is very much inspired by people I've met, you know, particularly from that order, and it's amazing how they pop up in different places I go. I mean, as I said, I first encountered them tending to migrants in... at the Mexican border, but then when I was, and this is another aspect, you know, this is some territory I explore in the book, when I was doing stories about the African migrant communities, immigrant communities in southern Italy who live in the turf that is dominated by the Neapolitan mafia, the Camorra, sure enough, I met, you know, priests from that same order who were there ministering to the African immigrants, some of whom had lived in Chicago before and, you know, knew neighborhoods that I knew, these priests, you know, when they had been based in Chicago dealing with the Italian-American community. So it was just, it's amazing how characters like that make, you know, bring these places together, you know, and that's one of the things I'm trying to show in the book, even though the story kind of sprawls all over in a lot of different directions, you know, these places are closer together than they seem, and these people are more connected than they seem because, you know, of the way those networks and those underworlds work.
Well, I think in the case of the priests, how they work and the environment in which they work sort of belies, as you mentioned, their sophistication and the idea that Catholic priests have had about 2,000 years of cultivating these kinds of networks. And it's just something I've personally been fascinated with. So, you know, it's my own personal hobby horse.
Well, it's, you know, and it's funny because in the book, I mean, one of my characters, Pescatore, is on the one hand very disillusioned with the Catholic Church and with the clergy in particular for obvious reasons, yet on the other, he can't help but be, you know, won over by the dedication and the selflessness of, you know, somebody who's decided to devote themselves to that kind of ministry, which is, you know, probably somewhat reflects some of my thinking about the issue, too.
I have two more questions. And the first one is that Valentin and Leo are doing their best to save innocence in this particular story, but they also have to grapple with their personal lives. And you mentioned Señor Mendez is now living in the U.S. near San Diego. And to his wife's great distress, and he loves his wife, he's continuing to investigate the types of individuals and situations who have vowed to kill him in Mexico. And Valentin is still, well, hopeless when it comes to love. He has fraught relationships with both the women in his life, Fatima, who is the French law enforcement officer he met in The Convict's Song, which is your previous novel, and Isabel, the Cuban-American who's now with Homeland Security and who enlists Valentin to help him with this. But so and I'll tie it into the next question, which is I hope there's a fourth Valentin novel in the works, and does his love life get any clearer?
I think part of the point of Pescatore is that he's always tormented and conflicted one way or the other, you know, and also a man of honor, you know, so he's trying to, you know, resolve his conflicts and do the right thing and show self-control and be honest and loyal when he finds himself, you know, between these two romances and can never quite, and you know, between one thing and the other, he's having to wrestle with this dilemma, and we'll see if it resolves. I'm not going to say anything about it yet. I mean, the other thing about, as for Mendez, I mean, I think you put your finger on something. I mean, one of the things that Mendez is trying to show, and one of the things I try and show in this book through Mendez and another character, an Italian prosecutor, is I've always had great admiration for people like Mendez or like prosecutors or cops who investigate the mafia, or corruption, or just, you know, who are up against incredible odds and face incredible danger and live this life, which is known in Spanish as la vida blindada, or in Italian as la vita blindata, which means the armored life, where they're so menaced that they and their families have to live in these controlled, fortified environments and move around with bodyguards and constantly be calculating, you know, the most mundane excursion, you know, whether it's shopping or to a restaurant, like a paramilitary operation, and the wear and tear that has on them, not just the physical danger, but psychologically. You know, and one of the things that Mendez has done by going into exile and going to San Diego and bringing his family there is trying to have a family, you know, and trying to do things like go to his son's soccer game and have a decent family life and, you know, not always put the family and himself at risk, but not always put this obsession and this battle ahead of everything else, including his personal life. But, you know, because he has this calling, you know, he finds himself inevitably drawn back to that fight with the toll it takes. And again, that's just on him, but on his family. So I wanted to show that, you know, because I've seen that and I know people like that who've told me about it, you know, whether, you know, just an Italian prosecutor I know who at one point was threatened by both the mafia and al-Qaeda. You know, he had moved from investigating the mafia in Sicily to investigating terrorism in the early 2000s. And, you know, and every time I saw him, he was with, you know, seven bodyguards, two carloads of bodyguards. And the problem was, again, as he would say to me, you know, it's not just the danger to me and the fact that, like, bodyguards have to go with my kids to the playground, but everything I do, I'm not just putting myself in danger, I'm putting all these, you know, these young men and women who are guarding me in danger too, you know. So that was part of what I was trying to show with Mendez, is the psychology of living that way. As for the fourth book, you know, we'll see. I mean, I have decided, and I won't talk about it much, but you're always so good to me and to my books. I mean, I'll give you a little bit of an insight that I think I'm really thinking about. I do want to continue with Pescatore, and I love the character. I am thinking about doing in a different direction and doing a standalone with a different character for the next book. For a series of reasons, and partly because of the kind of worlds I want to explore with that book. But he's a character that I'm very attached to, Pescatore, and he will definitely be back.
Well, all right, we can let you have a standalone. You've got your trilogy, so you can have. You have my permission. You can do this with my
Thank
permission.
Thank you. Bless you. No, I think that it's like I said. I mean, I think. There are just some things I want to write about in the world of terrorism in particular, where that require a different kind of investigator and a different kind of approach, and that's the new book I'm working on. I can also mention that the Convert Song the script is being written. I've actually seen recently the script for a film, so I'm very excited about that, about seeing the possibility of Pescatore and the Convert Song making their way towards the big screen.
Well, I think that that would make an amazing movie, actually, especially how you constructed the book with the musical allusions. It really will lend itself, I think. Not that what I think is meaningful in any way in the production world, but I think it's a compelling story. I think all three of your novels have been compelling stories, but, you know, I'm a fangirl. What can I say?
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you again, Sebastian, for your time and for talking to us and telling us sort of what are the underpinnings of your most recent book of Rip Crew, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.